My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Jane Ann Phillips. Jane Ann, welcome to Portland. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
You're here for your book, Lark and Termite, which, even though the way the title sounds, is not a nature book. Well, not human nature, maybe, but it's not about birds and insects.
Not exactly.
Published by Knopf. I don't normally ask this because I know one of the things that writers hate is we ask, where do you get your ideas? But it seems to me that maybe something precipitated this book. Was there an incident, something you heard, something you read that gave you the impetus for this book?
Well, 30 years ago, I was visiting a friend in my hometown, and she had rented a little apartment on the second floor of a detached garage that looked out on this kind of lush grass alley. And there were several little houses that fronted the alley, and there was a kind of 1950s aluminum lawn chair in one of them, and sitting in that chair was a boy with his legs kind of folded up under him. He was holding up to his forehead a long blue strip of what looked like a kind of blue dry cleaner bag, and he was blowing on it constantly so that it kept moving in front of his eyes. And I said to my friend, "Who is that and what is he doing?" And she said, "I don't know, but he sits that way for hours." And the image of that boy sort of really stayed with me. And a few years later, a friend of mine gave me a page in her sketchbook that I'd admired. You know, she just sort of ripped it out and gave it to me. And it was immediately, to my mind, the image of that boy, maybe a little bit older, kind of in profile. And it's sort of an abstract line drawing. And he seemed to be holding something up to his face that had a kind of movement to it. And that actually appears in the book, thanks to Knopf's incredible designers, as a frontispiece. And in the book, it is Lark's drawing of her brother Termite.
Mm-hmm. Lark is a girl, a teenage girl, high school.
Lark is 17.
She's in business school, though, rather than regular.
She graduated early, and she's sort of taking secretarial types of courses at night and taking care of Termite during the day. Both of these kids have been raised by their maternal aunt.
Aunt Noni.
Yeah. And the book is told basically from four points of view. Lark's voice, Noni's voice in first person, and a third person points of view of Levitt, Termite's father, who is killed very early in the Korean War, and whose death sets in motion sort of a realm of circumstance. I mean, there's a line in the book, every soldier's death lasts for a generation. And Lark knows that Termite's father was killed in the war, and that's really all they know about him. They never got his body back. They don't know what happened to him. And in fact, as the reader understands, Levitt is very much aware that his son is about to be born in the States as he is participating in an evacuation of a Korean village.
Why Termite?
Why is he named Termite?
Why is he named Termite, yes.
Initially, the drawing that my friend gave me, she had sort of scribbled around the edge in almost, you know, illegible handwriting, something about termite knocks on wood and finds it good. And that had some private meaning for her, but for me, he became Termite. And actually, in the book, Lark gives the reason in their world that he's called Termite. One reason is they never know his real name. They never know his real birthday. They don't have a birth certificate for him. But she says, and he was so small when he came to us. He was always small for his age. He was like a mite. You know, Noni called him a mite. And he always moved his fingers as though he's kind of feeling the air like an insect might move in an antennae. And mite kind of turned into termite. And Lark actually says something about he's in himself the way a termite's in a wall, because he doesn't communicate normally. He doesn't speak. He doesn't walk. Yet his hearing is extremely intense. And in fact, the reader knows more about him in some ways than the characters in the book can know, because they're able to enter his perceptions through sections of the book that are written from his point of view.
Let's set the book. The book takes place in two similar periods in July, 9 years apart and, 10 or 12,000 miles apart, one in North Chungcheong province in South Korea, mm-hmm. at the beginning of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And is it Winfield, West Virginia, a small mm-hmm. town in West Virginia, 9 years later?
It's the same 3 days, July, I think it's July
26, 27.
July 26, 27, 28.
Something like that, yeah.
And those days in Korea center on a particular event, an atrocity that occurred early in the Korean War at a bridge called Nogun-ri. And that's the incident that that Levitt is involved in. He tries to protect or help a Korean girl who is carrying on her back her brother who can't walk.
And her old mother or grandmother?
And she's trying to help her grandmother or great aunt as well, and he sort of wades into the crowd to help her, and at that point the incident begins. And I did a great deal of research into the beginning of the Korean War, and in particular the incident at Nogun-ri, using a lot of the research and the series of articles that Martha Mendoza and Charles Hanley and that group of reporters who actually won a Pulitzer for revealing the incident at Nogun-ri, which in fact was secret for 50 years. And it took place under a double railroad tunnel. And I had already written Lark's section of the novel in which the children in 1959 in this small town, they spend time at the train yard by the river, and there's a double railroad tunnel in which they congregate, they play, and Termite is fascinated by big sounds and big vibrations. And when he hears storms or he sits under that tunnel as the train is moving overhead, he almost goes into kind of a fugue state, and he sees images that he doesn't recognize, but the reader recognizes them. So the book, in a way, presents this parallel world, and the reader moves back and forth between them. As secrets are kind of slowly revealed about both those worlds.
There's a classic congruence of setting here that you know, the Greek poets might have recognized because they like to have setting or action be equalized across no matter how broad their scope was. So I was reading this, I was thinking, yeah, this could be recognized by the Greeks as a classic drama, even because one could take place on Olympus and the other on the Earth, but
exactly. There's a constant communication or a kind of constant spiritual realm that's operating between
exactly,
them.
Exactly, yeah. I'm telling you exactly. Of course, you know that. when I read this book, I very cleverly said, oh, there's a kind of a Faulknerian thing going on here, you know. And then, of course, every review I've read of this book since then mentions that, so I'm really not as clever as I thought. But by the way, congratulations on a great review, not only in the New York Times, but also in Entertainment Weekly. It got glowing reviews from both places.
In which one?
Entertainment Weekly.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, yeah. It's the current issue, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
And, of course, the New York Times, which is the, you know, the holy grail of good reviews. So good for you. Do you consider yourself, I mean, when you think about, you know, the Faulknerian tradition, do you consider yourself a Southern writer in the tradition of Eudora Welty? Or how do you place yourself? Or do you even bother to think about it?
Well, I think I'm an American writer. And it's interesting because West Virginia is considered an Appalachian time zone. It's not really part of the Northeast. It's not really part of the South.
Oh, it's its own place.
Its own place. So in a sense, I'm an Appalachian writer, but there's a big cross current between Southern writers and Appalachian writers, I think. Mm-hmm. But my influences really range from all of those Southern writers. I mean, I love writers who write like outlaws in the sense that they don't really observe any rules. And
he looks like Harry Cruz.
Harry Cruz. I like Harry Cruz. I like James Agee. Yeah. I love Bruno Schultz. I love
Bruno
Kafka.
Schultz? I don't know Bruno Schultz. I
love Bruno Schultz.
He's a Southerner?
No.
I know Kafka isn't a Southerner, unless it's South, you know, Czechoslovakia. But...
No, Bruno Schultz was killed by the Nazis. He was Polish. Uh-huh. And he wrote a wonderful book called Street of Crocodiles, and you've got a treat in store if you don't know his work yet.
I'll look him up.
He was a contemporary in the sense of Kafka. Mm-hmm. But I really love writers who deal with perception itself, who try to represent perception itself and the way we think and remember and dream and fantasize. And the things we know that we don't know, we know. I mean, I think literature can tap into that. There is this almost realm of knowledge that's bigger than what the individual can know.
Meta-knowledge. Epistemology, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, all this is like a doctoral paper in this book. I mean, if I have any criticism of the book, and I like the book very much. Lark, in a way, is almost too sensitive and too articulate in her internal mind for a 17-year-old growing up in a not very stimulating place. Did you feel? I mean, why did you set her like that?
Well, no, I would disagree that it's a very stimulating place.
Oh yeah. Oh, okay.
It may not be a materially well-off place, but it's a place full of stories, and she's had a great deal of responsibility from the time she was quite young. She's a bit of an old soul, and I think, you know, bearing that kind of responsibility from a young age does make people kind of grow up a little faster. And women typically, particularly in a place like Appalachia, are really the tellers of tales, the carriers of stories. And there's a great deal of, I think when you take on a burden, there's a kind of gift involved. And she clearly sees Termite that way, partly because he's a link to all that she doesn't know about her own past and about her mother.
Mm-hmm. No, they have the same mother, but as we start the book, Lark doesn't really know who her father is.
Lark doesn't know.
Yeah, no, we know that Termite's father is Levitt, and that mm-hmm. Levitt has in fact died in Korea. Mm-hmm. But everything else is a mystery. Noni's not speaking. Mm-hmm. She's not telling anybody, and everybody in this little town they know, but they seem to want to protect her or to keep her shielded from what they consider to be ugly realities. There's a character here named Gladdy. Gladdy is there's a restaurant that Noni works at. She's a waitress at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. A server, excuse mm-hmm. me. Yes. And she Gladdy is the mother of Charlie,
who owns the restaurant.
Owns the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And she's bitter. She's bitter, she's mean, she's angry. She can't enjoy other people's joy, and she can't even participate in it. She can't even – she has no way to deal with joy. She has only a way to deal with hardness and I don't want to say cruelty, because I don't think she's cruel as much as she doesn't know the difference. Is that a fair description?
That's a pretty fair description.
Yeah, okay. Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Jane Ann Phillips. Jane is spelled J-A-Y-N-E, Jane Ann Phillips. The title of the book is Lark and Termite, published by Knopf. This book has almost biblical things happening in it, including a flood mm-hmm. at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And I tend to see everything maybe in terms of symbolic things. There, not knowing who your father is a classic, you know, a quest kind of a thing. The child, the spooky, mystical child who causes other people around him or her to react to them in certain ways and in fact causes things simply by being, although they can't participate in any action. All this stuff comes right out of classic literature. Was there a consciousness of that as you wrote the book?
Not really. I think my challenge was to sustain these parallel worlds, and I see war as a kind of man-made catastrophe that could be seen as being a sort of akin force to storms and weather, that simply we see them impending, we can't control them, they simply happen. And the flood is very much set up in the book as a sort of corresponding force to the war that is affecting all the characters in that first world.
It certainly does flush everything away, including the mysteries, doesn't it? At the end of the flood, everything is washed away and things become clearer.
And things become clearer.
Yeah.
Movement occurs.
Yeah, it's almost like a baptism and a rebirth of everybody in the book. Going too far there, am I?
You're good.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind of you to say. No, but I mean that's really the way I saw it, as though it was a refreshment mm-hmm. of what had become a stale, a fog in this little community.
Yeah, they talk about the river and the river being the color of the sky, and the book is full of inflections and inversions, and secrets that are revealed that I think at the end of the book may seem more obvious once you have all the pieces in place, but I think every human life is full of big questions. And they say politics is personal. And I think, you know, it is what we write about, the choices that we make. You know, they are political choices. And I think every human life is connected to, you know, realms and dimensions that aren't obvious. And we search for that meaning, all of us. And this is, you know, a record of a search that straddles nationalities, countries, wars, generations.
There's a, you know, I think most people are not, they don't have the time to be spiritual, insightful on a day-to-day basis. They may take some time every now and then for a little self-examination. But one of the things that Termite does is he forces everybody to relate to him in one way or another, mm-hmm. and it usually brings out the best in people because everybody is protective of him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if there's a question here. I'm not even sure myself what the question is in this, but is there a spiritual dimension in this book that you were seeking to put in it, or did it just emerge as you were writing the book?
I think it just emerged. I mean, we are all isolated inside our own identities, and empathy is the quality that we can bring to life, you know, as human beings, that we don't think exists in the animal kingdom, although some version of it might exist. And I think someone like Termite, as you say, does prompt, he prompts a reaction. And just the fact that he's in the world as he is sort of forces other people to think about themselves. And I think that's worth thinking about when we think about the idea of, quote, disability. Because, you know, we don't know what someone who can't communicate is really thinking or experiencing.
He seems, however, to be quite content within his own universe. He has, his needs are small and they're well taken care of, and even to the strips of blue plastic, which, you know, which are his primary plaything, I guess, they show him a way to look at the world. He likes looking through the blue and making the world change, looking through the blue plastic.
Well, you find out at the very end what those strips of blue and the way they move are echoing. Mm-hmm. You discover it with him in a
sense.
I don't
want to give anything away. No.
Yeah, let's not give anything away.
Okay.
I don't know. It's not so much that he's happy, because I think...
Not content. It's
yeah.
Not, you know, he's not discommoded by his existence.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know
okay.
about that.
All right. He doesn't seem to be anyway. I mean, that's... Let me ask you something about... there's an interesting ethnic thing running through this book. For example, let's talk about Lola, because we haven't talked about Lola. Lola is the mother of both Lark and Termite.
Mm-hmm.
She was the prettiest girl in town, and she was almost the prettiest girl in town no matter what town she went to.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to a she leaves town, and she goes to work as a quote-unquote hostess in a place near a military base, which is where Levitt meets her, because he's in the army going over to Korea. Levitt is a Jewish guy from Philadelphia who's a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, you know, we're starting to get real outsider here. He's an outsider no matter where he goes,
mm-hmm.
whether because of he's a musician or because he's a Jew and he's in the South or whatever it is. And Lola is attracted to him for maybe some of those same qualities, maybe not. And then we have next door neighbors in West Virginia who are ethnic Italian people in West Virginia. And I know that Italians came there to work the mines, so they're mm-hmm. not unknown in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also outside the mainstream of the village. They're a clan to themselves,
mm-hmm.
and good friends with Lark.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on here?
Maybe that everyone's an outsider in some way, whether it's obvious or not.
Mm-hmm.
And outsiders bring a certain perception of vision. They see things maybe without the same limiting context. And I mean, for instance, you know, Levitt's close friend in the war is a guy named Tompkins, who's Native American. And it sounds like a lot of disparate elements that are kind of thrown together, but in fact, they're very carefully woven together in a sense. So I think
I would expect nothing less.
Yeah. So when you're sort of reading the book, it does, they don't seem as though it's unlikely that these people would meet, because in fact, the world is so jumbled in the world in this book that all kinds of people are meeting all the time.
Certainly the military brings people together from disparate elements. We get to like Lola an awful lot and wish her better than she gets. We get to like Levitt. In fact, I begin to miss Levitt later in the book and wonder about his squashed jazz career, you know, being a jazz fan and knowing how many great jazz players came from Philadelphia, including Stan Getz was from Philadelphia.
How many died during the war?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the waste of human life and talent, of course, is, you know, what the worst thing about war. I kind of missed finding out about them. I almost wish there could be there could have been some alternative reality in which these people were able to live out their destinies.
Well, there might be. Such a reality might be suggested, I think, in the book.
Ah, okay. There was something I didn't pick up on right away. Charlie is the guy who owns the restaurant at which Noni works, Lola's sister Noreen, is a really, really nice man. And when I say really, really nice man, it's not just in contrast to his mother, who's the Wicked Witch of the West. It's that he's a compassionate, caring person who, I don't know, he's everybody in this book in some ways is a force for good, except Glady. But even among them, he stands out. Is Charlie too good to be true?
Oh, I don't think so. He made some big mistakes there. He caused a lot of complications.
He did, but, you know, they were mistakes, and he bent over backwards to correct those mistakes.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a little bit, or because I don't want to give away too much of the plot.
Yeah, we don't
want
to give away the don't want to give away the plot. But
if you give it away, it's fine. If I give it away, it's
Charlie is a kind of you know, he's Catholic. He's very hardworking. He kind of adopts both these kids. He watches out for them as his own kids. And he is Noni's longtime lover. I mean, they've been together from the time they were in high school. And then after a separation of many years, they come back together. And he is part of this community that, in a way, surrounds Termite. He's part of Termite's extended family, so to speak. And the reader finds out just how complex those relationships are as you sort of progress in the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, this I haven't read your first book, but I understand it also takes place at least partially in West Virginia.
Several of my books and stories are connected to West Virginia, and there are certain place names that are common to Machine Dreams, which dealt with the Vietnam War and took place in a town called Bellington, and the town Winfield and Bellington are both mentioned in Shelter as being sort of the nearby town. So this all, it's in a way, it's the same universe, so to speak.
Creating your own Yaknapatawpha County in West Virginia?
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. What are you working on now? What's going on with Jane Ann Phillips now in the creative part of your life?
Well, I'm working very hard on the Rutgers Newark MFA program, which is a brand new MFA program that started 2 years ago. I sort of took the job 4 years ago to design and develop the curriculum of a new program, and we're in Newark, New Jersey.
Rutgers, yeah.
At Rutgers, and we have a fabulous program there, and I'm the director. So it's kind of wearing four hats at once, working with young fiction writers, running an incredible reading series called Writers at Newark, doing a lot of community outreach to Newark based on literature. Looking for angels to help us. If anyone wants to get in touch with me about that, we're happy to do that. And I've started working on a new book, a book I've been thinking about for many years, really, that in its own way is connected to all the books. I mean, I think that my work is more or less a continuum, that one book is very much connected to the other. And so that's what I'm doing.
Philip Roth. Amiri Baraka, born Leroy Jones, Harlan Coben, all come from Newark. Is there a writer's tradition in Newark?
There is, and we're starting a new one because a lot of talented students are are coming to this program. Our students have published this year in McSweeney's and the Paris Review and Grant a Young Voices Online. Mm-hmm. And I fully expect them to be publishing, some of them to be publishing books in the next 5 to 10 years.
Do you see a trend among young writers? Are they, what are they thinking about?
Well, the writers that I'm working with are thinking about literature. I think that's what writers need to think about.
Really?
Yeah.
Not the world we live in? I mean,
of course we think about the world we live in. But I think, you know, history gives us the facts, but literature tells us the story. It tells us what the facts mean. And I think to have a real sense of the conscience of a culture, you look to the literature of that culture. And, of course, this country is so rich in that there are so many different voices, and that is changing and enlarging all the time. And I think young writers really need to read, and read.
I once wrote an essay entitled, Books Are Not Life, But Then What Is? So, you know, it's the old thing about the unexamined life is not worth living, but the unlived life is not worth examining either.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So these kids need to get out and get their butts kicked a little bit, too. That's, you know.
Well, that kind of happens these days.
In Newark especially, yes, yeah. It's really been delightful speaking to you. I've been speaking with Jane Ann Phillips. She's the author of Lark and Termite, published by Knopf. Please come back.
Happy to. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.